Okay, we are here talking about the ontological argument, and it's just you and me.
Just you and me.
Just like peas and carrots, we are. And we, last week, talked about the ontological argument, and we also... excuse me. We talked about several objections to the ontological argument. And now we're at the creme de la creme, the what is historically the most important objection. And so we're going to spend some time on this one. The ontological argument, as you remember, says that the mere idea of God proves that God is real because if God is the greatest conceivable being, and if I assume that God does not exist, I'm assuming automatically that it is possible that a greater than the greatest conceivable exists, namely one that does exist. And since the denial of God's existence entails a contradiction, you must affirm the necessity of God's existence. Here's what Kant says about the argument. And this is a summary of what we're about to read. A, existence is not a predicate. B, the ontological argument presupposes that existence is a predicate. Therefore, C, the ontological argument is unsound.
Do you define predicate?
Well, we're going to define everything as we get into this. And I'm going to go ahead, for the sake of those who are listening, read this entire quotation.
Okay.
This is bad pedagogy, but fun philosophy. Here's what Kant says. Being is obviously not a real predicate. That is, it is not a concept of something which could be added to the concept of being or concept of a thing. It is merely the positing of a thing or of certain determinations as existing in themselves. Logically, it is merely the copula of a judgment. The proposition, God is omnipotent, contains two concepts, each of which has its object, God and omnipotence. The small word is adds no new predicate, but only serves to posit the predicate in its relation to the subject. In this case, the predicate being omnipotent and the subject being God. If now we take, and then Kant goes on, if now we take the subject, God, with all of its predicates, among which is omnipotence, and say God is, or there is a God, we attach no new predicate to the concept of God, but only posit the subject in itself with all its predicates. And we posit it as being an object that stands in relation to my concept. The concept of both must be one and the same. Nothing can have been added to the concept which expresses merely what is possible by my way of thinking its object through the expression it is as given absolutely. Otherwise stated, the real contains no more than the merely possible. 100 real thalers, or dollars in our case, do not contain the least coin more than 100 possible dollars. For as the latter signify the concept, and the former the object, and the positing of the object, should the former contain more than the latter, my concept would not, in that case, express the whole object and would not, therefore, be an adequate concept of it. My financial position is, however, affected very differently by 100 real dollars than it is by the mere concept of them, that is, of their possibility. For the object, as it actually exists, is not analytically contained in my concept, but is added to my concept, which is the determination of my state, synthetically. And yet, the conceived $100 are not themselves in the least increased through thus acquiring existence outside of my concept. By whatever and however many predicates we may think a thing, even if we completely determine it, we do not make the least addition to the thing when we further declare that the thing is. Otherwise, it would not be exactly the same thing that exists, but something more than we had thought in the concept. And we could not, therefore, say that the exact object of my concept exists. If we think in a thing every feature of reality except one, The missing reality is not added by my saying that this defective thing exists. On the contrary, it exists with the same defect with which I have thought it, since otherwise what exists would be something different from what I thought. When, therefore, I think a being as the supreme reality, without any defect, the question still remains whether it exists or not. For though in my concept nothing may be lacking of the possible real content of a thing in general, something is still lacking in its relation to my whole state of thought, namely, insofar as I'm able to assert, that knowledge of this object is also possible a posteriori or from experience. And here we find the source of our present difficulty. We are dealing with an object of the senses. Were we dealing with the object of the senses, we could not confound the existence of the thing with the mere concept of it. For though through the concept, the object is thought only as conforming to the universal conditions of possible empirical knowledge in general, whereas through its existence, it is thought as belonging to the content of experience as a whole. And being thus connected with the content of experience as a whole, the concept of the object is not, however, in the least enlarged. All that has happened is that our thought is thereby can obtain an additional possible perception. It is not, therefore, surprising that if we attempt to think existence through the pure category alone, we cannot specify a single mark distinguishing it from mere possibility. Whatever, therefore, and however much our concept of an object may contain, we must go outside it if we care to ascribe existence to the object. In the case of objects of the senses, this takes place through their connection with some one of our perceptions in accordance with empirical laws. But in dealing with objects of pure thought, we have no means whatsoever of knowing their existence, since it would have to be known in a completely a priori manner. Our consciousness of all existence, whether immediately through perception or immediately through inferences which connect something with perception, belongs exclusively to the unity of experience. Any alleged existence outside of this field, while not indeed such as we can declare to be absolutely impossible, is of the nature of an assumption which we can never be in a position to justify. Excuse me. The concept of a supreme being is in many respects a very useful idea. But just because it is a mere idea, it is altogether incapable by itself alone of enlarging our knowledge in regard to what exists. It is not even competent to enlighten us as to the possibility of any existence beyond which is known in and through experience. The analytic criterion of possibility, as consisting in the principle that bare positives give rise to no contradiction, cannot be denied. But since realities are not given to us in their specific characters, since even if they were, we should still be in a position to pass judgment, since the criterion of the possibility of synthetic knowledge is never to be looked for save in experience, to which the object of an idea cannot belong, the connection of all real properties in a thing is a synthesis, the possibility of which we are unable to determine a priori. And thus the celebrated Leibniz is far from having succeeded in what he plumbed himself on achieving, the comprehension a priori of the possibility of this sublime ideal being. The attempt to establish the existence of a supreme being by means of the famous ontological argument of Descartes is therefore merely so much labor and effort lost. We could no more extend our stock of theoretical insights by mere ideas than a merchant can better his position by adding a few noughts to his cash account. Now, this is a difficult passage to interpret. Part of the reason for this is that it presupposes many of the epistemological ideas Kant expounds earlier in the critique. Another reason is that Kant's writing style is somewhat rigid and full of his own particular jargon. But the major reason this passage is difficult is that the objection Kant is raising is itself just plain hard to understand. One thing to keep in mind as we reflect on Kant's objection is that his whole argument is given to demonstrate what he says in this final paragraph, namely, in a nutshell, you can't just define things into existence. The defender of the ontological argument is trying to define God into existence by treating the word existence like a property someone or something may or may not have. If I say, The table in front of me is red. I have added the concept or property of being red to the concept of being a table. When I note that a table is red, I'm telling myself and possibly others something about the table that cannot be known by merely reflecting on the word table. After all, people can contemplate in their minds all sorts of tables of different colors, shapes, and sizes. Thus, when I say, the table in front of me is red, I'm distinguishing this table from others that might exist. And since the property of being red is not automatically built into the idea of table, my knowledge that this table is red is a knowledge of something new about the table. So do you see how redness adds to my knowledge of the table? The predicate red, if I say it's red, I now know something about the table that I may not have known before.
Yes, but the table existed before you knew it anyway.
Yeah, but if I have the lights off and I know that there's a table in front of me, when I turn the lights on and see that it's red, I now have some new knowledge of the table.
But that doesn't change anything about what it is.
It doesn't change anything about what it is as the table.
But
it does distinguish this table from other tables. And even if you say, well, there are other red tables that look exactly like it. Yeah, but the table in front of me is the only table in front of me. So I can talk about spatial properties too. I can say the red table is sitting in the corner of the room. What room? Well, the sanctuary, for example, or the office or whatever. Whose office? Well, my office.
That seems to me, I mean, it makes sense, but it seems to really only be important for us because the table's existence and whether it's red or not is not contingent on whether or not we know that. The table sitting in the dark before you ever see it is still, or could be at least, still red. And then therefore, it doesn't really matter if you, to the table at least, if you turn the light on and say, oh, the table's red. When it makes a difference is for us, sure. But if these things, if we're talking about something, take something eternal for existence, we're not creating it. And we're not necessarily defining it into existence. It's just now becoming important to us because we have some knowledge of it that we didn't have before. But if it always existed, it doesn't seem really like a big deal other than the fact that maybe we are gaining new knowledge about it. It always existed. It was always there. We just never shined a light on it.
Okay, but the whole point is this. I had a concept of table in my mind before I bumped into it. My bumping into it doesn't change the concept of table in my mind. A table is a table. I'm not adding new knowledge to the word table.
Right.
By knowing that it exists.
Okay, but it still exists.
Yeah, but we're talking about whether we know that it exists. Do you know that God exists? Well, the ontological argument has been offered as a proof to say you can know that God exists through this argument. All right? So is your knowledge of God increased by knowing that God exists? Well, that's the question. Is existence a predicate in the same way that redness is a predicate? If I say the table is red, I've learned something new about the table that I don't just get from tables in my mind. But if I say the table exists, have I really learned anything new about the table? Mm-hmm. All right, well, see, then the next question is this. Is existence a predicate in the same way redness is? Can I say the table in front of me exists, and from that statement know anything new about the table that I did not know about it before? That seems absurd, reasons Kant. A table is, after all, just a table, whether it exists or not. I might find myself in a better position if I realize that there's a real table before me, especially if it's supper time and I need a place to eat. Or maybe I need to do homework or study or whatever, and there's a table and I can read at the table. But I know nothing more about a table by knowing that it is real. A table possesses all of its essential properties regardless of whether it exists or not. In the same way, my financial condition may surely be improved if I find myself possessing 100 real dollars. But I know no more about the $100 in my pocket than I do the $100 in my mind. $100 is $100. real or imagined. Poimen has given other insights that might help us here. He suggests that we might interpret Kant as follows. Anselm has confused second-order properties with first-order properties. First-order properties are those that are exemplified in the real world. Hence, the property of being blue is exemplified in our world, for example, in the sky, and hence is a first-order property. However, second-order properties are those that are possible but not actual. They are not exemplified in the real world. The property of being a unicorn is not exemplified in our world, and hence is a second-order property. This helpful distinction aids us in securing a fundamental intuition that more than a few philosophers have maintained, namely, the real must first be possible, but the possible is not always real. Poimen suggests that the point Kant is trying to make might go something like this. If existence is a property, it is an odd kind of property that can't exist without first-order properties. This is why we label it a second-order property. It tells us whether the other properties are exemplified. Hence, saying the table exists tells us nothing about the table. It tells us that the property of being a table has been exemplified in the real world. Finally, we note another example or helpful insight of Poimen. Poimen does this. He says, this is really good. He goes, if existence is not a property, it is not a perfection either. Suppose Lisa and Jane each wrote down the qualities of a perfect husband. Here are their list. Lisa's list says this, intelligence, kindness, sense of humor, attractive, moral integrity. These are the perfections of the perfect husband. Jane has a list, and hers goes like this, intelligence, kindness, sense of humor, attractive, moral integrity, and existence. So her list looks exactly like Lisa's list, except she adds the word existence to it. Lisa's and Jane's lists are identical except for the quality of existence on Jane's list, but is Jane's list really better? I don't think so. Jane has misunderstood the purpose of the list, which is to set forth the qualities of a perfect husband, the qualities a perfect husband would have. It's another matter whether these qualities are exemplified in an actual man. In a similar way, it is one thing to say that God is omnipotent, omniscient, or even the greatest conceivable being. But it's another matter altogether to say that such qualities have been exemplified in a real being. Why did Kant insist on this point so tenaciously? Well, his concerns seem to be fair and clear. If a person insists that existence is a predicate, then we find ourselves in the unfortunate position of being able to define anything into existence. If existence makes a difference in how we understand a concept, then anything goes. And no one, including the overzealous theist who is trying to prove God exists, wants that. So to sum up, if existence is not a predicate, then the ontological argument cannot be sound. For on the ontological argument, existence is a property the greatest conceivable being necessarily has. But if Kant is right, this is a statement that cannot be coherently made, and therefore the ontological argument is unsound. Now before we take one more step, and let me give an answer to this objection, because we've just been doing this whole time, we've just been expounding upon the objection. So my question to you is, do you understand this objection?
Yes, I believe I do.
Okay, very good. So, first, the first thing I want to say is, we got to calm any fears that in acceptance of the ontological argument will open up a situation in which anything goes philosophically. Since the greatest conceivable being is by definition a different kind of thing than we are used to contemplating, it is certainly possible that something can be true of this being that is not true of others. Hence, saying that the greatest conceivable being exists by definition might be allowed. But we would not allow this to be said of a unicorn, for example. Indeed, I can certainly conceive of something greater than a unicorn, like the greatest conceivable being, and hence it is surely illegitimate to simply define a unicorn into being. Second, we must ask whether Kant is attacking the right argument. He is, to be sure, attacking an ontological argument. However, as he explicitly says, Descartes is the thinker he has in mind, not Anselm. But I, for one, do not think Descartes gave us a good ontological argument. Here's what Descartes says. God possesses all perfections. Existence is a perfection. Therefore, God exists. That's Descartes' argument. And I am not alone in thinking that Anselm's version of the argument is quite different from Descartes' version. Plantinga says, couldn't Anselm thank Kant for this point, that existence is not a perfection, and proceed merrily on his way? Where did Anselm try to define God into being by adding existence to a list of properties that define some concept? According to the great German philosopher and pessimist Arthur Schopenhauer, the ontological argument arises when someone excogitates a conception composed out of all sorts of predicates, among which, however, he takes care to include the predicate actuality or existence, either openly or wrapped up for decency's sake in some other predicate, such as perfection, immensity, or something of the kind. If this were Anselm's procedure, if he had simply added existence to a concept that has application contingently, if at all, then indeed his argument would be subject to the Kantian criticism. But he didn't, and therefore it isn't. Let's look at Plantinga's point in terms of premise four of Davis's ontological argument. Whatever exists only in the mind and might possibly exist in reality might possibly be greater than it is. How is this premise anything at all like Descartes' existence is a perfection? All we are saying here is that if something exists, it is freer or able to do more things than if it does not exist. But this is not really the same thing as saying that existence is a predicate or a perfection. Since I can still agree with Kant that I know nothing more about a concept that is exemplified than one that is not. A real $100 is the same idea as an imaginary $100, true. But a real $100 is greater than an imaginary $100 in the sense that it has more purchasing power than its imaginary rival. Third, even if Kant's criticism did apply to Anselm's argument, it's not clear that it renders the ontological argument invalid. Indeed, is it not the case that, at least on some occasions, existence is a predicate? Are there not at least some occasions in which I would understand a concept better if I knew that it exists than if I didn't know that it exists? Surely there are some. For example, take objects we don't know for sure exist. Kant's objection may very well hold when we contemplate concepts we know are real, like birds and tables. But it does not seem to hold when discussing concepts whose existence is a matter of dispute. Telling me that tables are real does not expand my understanding of the idea. However, and this is what Davis says, I am quite sure that my concept of the Loch Ness Monster would change if someone were to convince me that the creature exists, that there really is, let's say, a reproducing colony of plesiosaurs in the loch left over from the Cretaceous period. Here exists is a real predicate. Also, as we suggested in the previous response, there are properties that real things have that merely possible things do not have. 100 imaginary dollars is not a different concept as 100 real dollars when discussing the number of dollars in question. But 100 real dollars have at least one property that 100 imaginary dollars cannot possibly have, namely, the property of having purchasing power in the real world. Thus, I can, at least in some sense, know something about the $100 in my pocket that I don't know about the $100 in my head. Fourth, and closely related to the previous point, Kant's criticism fails to clearly distinguish contingent and necessary existence. Malcolm has discerned two ontological arguments in Anselm's work, namely one that assumes existence is a predicate, which Malcolm agrees is invalid, and one that assumes necessary existence is a predicate, which Malcolm supports. There are, after all, two modalities, contingency and necessity. For ideas that either contingently exist, like the planet Earth, or contingently fail to exist, like Travis Campbell's 10th daughter, existence may very well add nothing new to the concepts, for in either case the ideas, at least at one time or another, are not instantiated in reality. And once a contingent idea is exemplified, its current existence adds nothing new to the concept of it. But now imagine a being who cannot not exist. To say the least, such a being may be one that, if it is real, exists in a manner which is altogether different than any contingent fact in our universe. For such a being, its necessary existence may very well be a perfection, since the very fact that it cannot fail to exist just is the reason to think of it as the greatest conceivable being. Hence the argument, first of all, I cannot conceive a greater, let me back up. So what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to give a very quick summary of the ontological argument to show you how existence could be a perfection. I can conceive of a greater than the greatest conceivable being who does not necessarily exist, namely one that does. Therefore, the greatest conceivable being is necessarily existent. Fifth, the assertion existence cannot, under any circumstances, be a predicate may very well entail solipsism. A solipsist is one who believes that he is the only reality. Everything he thinks is real is just an idea in his mind. Kant, of course, clearly rejects this perspective, and yet, if my knowing that a concept exists does not give me any new information about the concept in question, then how am I to distinguish the real from the non-real? How do I know that all that goes on outside of myself is really distinguished from what goes on within my own mind? But surely I can know the difference, or the differences, between mere concepts and exemplified ideas. The real $100 in my pocket have a certain texture, a feel, a smell, purchasing power, and indexical properties. For example, now I can touch this money I've received, whereas before I could not. So at T1, that is at a certain time, this real money has the property of being touched by Travis Campbell. Now, we can go on with that, but that's simply these things that are true that I'm saying simply cannot be had by $100 in my mind. So do you see how the real $100 in my pocket have properties simply because they are real that the $100 in my mind don't have, and therefore I can know the difference between the real and the merely mental.
Now, you can imagine those properties, but I guess you wouldn't know those properties if it was not real.
Right.
So if whatever was in your mind was always imaginary, your money was always imaginary, you would not know that it smells a certain way. You would not be able to feel.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Hence, not only can we think of examples in which existence is a predicate, we must know that Kant's criticism may very well entail a conclusion that he himself wants to deny. Finally, Kant's critique of the ontological argument rests in large part, and as we have seen, upon his theory of knowledge. We will engage his theory of knowledge at another point. But suffice to say here that there are more than a few problems with Kant's epistemology. Now, you and I have already done this. In Veltan Chong, we actually laid out his agnosticism, and while we didn't give a full exposition of his theory of knowledge, I told you enough about his agnosticism to let you know that there's more problems going on here than just his critique of the ontological argument. So what he does is he sets up his epistemology, and then he actually argues that his critique of the classical arguments do not depend upon his epistemology. But I think that they do. But in either case, I just don't think that this is a sound objection to the ontological argument. It's more involved. It sounds more intelligent. And a lot of people have gravitated towards it. In fact, it is Immanuel Kant who gave an argument its name. So people have joked that, you know, when he was burying it, he decided to, what am I going to name this thing that I just buried? And he types that. He hammers that out with chisel on the gravestone of the ontological argument. But that's, in a nutshell, his argument and my response. Do you have any questions about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, just reviewing briefly Kant's kind of theory of knowledge. I know you said we will return to it or come back
sure,
to it later time.
Sure.
If I understand correctly, he followed the approach that we have categories in our mind. Basically, you have the noumenal world here above, that where exists, you know, God and all these ethereal things that we really can't understand. And there's a huge gulf. And then what is the bottom knowledge?
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal. And there's categories within that that we have to understand things.
Yeah, you're born in this world with certain categories. What he's trying to do, and we have time, I guess, so I'll do a quick exposition. What he's trying to do is he's trying to reconcile the rationalists with the empiricists. He's trying to give what some have called a rational empiricism. And so you're born in this world with these categories. Now, the categories are themselves empty. So like the law of non-contradiction doesn't have any content to it. To put content into your mind, you have to have experience. And so the categories are like the old ice cube tray, where you would actually fill it up with water. And you put it in the freezer, right? So your mind is born with these kind of jello molds or ice cube trays. The form of the categories must fit the form, but the content that comes is through experience. So Kant had a saying, concepts without percepts are blank, but percepts without concepts are blind. You have conceptions and you have perceptions. Your conceptions without your perceptions just have no content to them. However, your perceptions without conceptions have no way of really, they have no discernment to them. Empiricism suffers from this problem of arbitrarily interpreting the influx of sense data. Like, how do you interpret them? If you're not born with certain concepts or ideas that are just fixed, then there's no way to interpret the world around you. And that's why you have people like Richard Carey saying, well, we invented logic. Kant would rightly say to Carey, that's crazy. There's no way that can be true, because the statement we invented logic becomes just an arbitrary assertion that you've used to interpret your experience by. And you simply don't know enough about the world to even give such an interpretation. And therefore, that's why it's just pure arbitrariness for you to even say that. So he is right. I'm actually a rational empiricist myself, in the sense that I do think that if I weren't born in this world with certain categories of thought, I could never interpret the world around me. Mm-hmm. But what he said, and this is the move he made that's so crucial, he said that the categories can never be used to interpret the noumenal world. Well, why? Well, he said that whenever we get into that, we end up embracing contradictions. You have antinomies that can't be fully understood. So, for example, or not just antinomies that can't be fully understood, antinomies that cannot in principle be reconciled. So, just to give you one example, take the statement, the universe, remember he said that the noumenal world is God, the soul, and the world as a whole. So let's look at the world as a whole real quickly. The universe is eternal. Well, there's a problem there. If the universe is eternal, and Kant says this in so many words, then that means an infinite number of moments have preceded the moment that we're experiencing right now. What's the problem with that? Well, here's an example. Imagine a man trying to count to zero from negative infinity. Is he ever going to get to his destination?
So yeah. Nothing is actually happening.
He's reaching any point. Imagine he's going -3, -2, -1. Well, you could look at him and say, well, why did you get to zero today? I mean, you had an eternity to get there. And this is the problem of traversing the infinite.
Which is, I guess, a much simpler version of that argument, isn't it? Basically, there is no distance, the point A to point B.
Right. It's taking Zeno's paradoxes and it's applying it to time. And so, if you say that the universe is eternal, that means you and I traverse, or this moment in time, this is a traversing of an infinite number of moments to get to right now. But just like the man who can't count to zero from negative infinity can't traverse the infinite, there's no reason to think the universe could do so as well. And so you have to say that the universe had a beginning. But then Kant says, okay, well, the universe had a beginning then. Well, what's the problem with that? Well, that means that there must have been a time before time. Right? So now we're in a paradox. And so if you said, okay, well, so what do we do about this? Kant says, stop trying to say things about the universe as a whole. The categories of the human mind cannot be used to come to such conclusions. Mm-hmm. Now, Augustine solved the second antinomy long ago. Augustine said that creation is not a beginning in time, it's the beginning of time. So there is no time before time.
Right.
And so, with that paradox solved, and the other paradox not resolved, we say that the universe had a beginning. Mm-hmm. But that's one example of an antinomy that Kant used to illustrate the fact that the categories of human thinking must be limited to mere phenomena.
And yet, it's not limited enough for him to make that argument.
Right, and so what I did is, instead of getting into the antinomies of pure reason, what I did is, he had four, okay? And then he had,
we didn't go over those.
And then he had another set of antinomies regarding the soul, and we didn't go over those. Because what you can do is, you can really just get out of this whole thing easily by saying to him, look, if you say what you're saying, then you basically are saying that you know that you can't know. To draw a line between noumenal and phenomenal realms just is an application or the use of the categories to know the noumenal realm. You have to know enough about the noumenal realm to know where it begins or where it and the phenomenal realm ends. And therefore, this whole enterprise is self-defeating, Mr. Kant. And this is why Norman Kent Smith, the great commentator on his work, says he's the least consistent of the great systematic philosophers, which is a problem. Mm-hmm. By the way, though, J. Gresham Machen, my hero, refused to take his ordination exams until he read all of Kant, not all of them, but at least read the Critique, and he answered it fully to his own satisfaction. And so one of the reasons I spend time on this is I'm trying to emulate Machen. Okay, the ontological argument begs the question. The most articulate form of this objection comes from William Rowe, who has entered into a protracted debate with Davis over the ontological argument. What does it mean for an argument to be question begging? Most of us realize that a person is begging the question just in case his premises used to justify his conclusion already implicitly or explicitly assume the conclusion. A classic example is as follows. The Bible is the word of God. The Bible says that God exists, therefore God exists. Premise A implicitly states the conclusion at the outset of the argument. Hence, the argument begs the question. How does the ontological argument beg the question? Rowe first asks us to consider a simple ontological argument. And here's the argument. God is defined as an existing, supremely perfect being. Some possible object is God, therefore God actually exists. Embedded in the first premise is what Rowe calls the preliminary conclusion, namely, no non-existing thing is God. Normally, when a person considers whether or not a concept is logically possible, he simply analyzes the terms used to describe or define the concept in question, and then judges whether there are any contradictions in the terms. However, in this simple ontological argument, allowing the truth of the second premise automatically entails allowing the existence of God, since, as we can see, the existence of God is already embedded in the very first premise. By accepting the second premise, we are, in a sense, being fooled into believing that God exists. When we think about what is possible, we usually think of things like you and me, things that are possible and happen to exist, or things like unicorns, that is, things that are possible and happen to not exist. But when we accept the second premise, we are really accepting the bare possibility. Excuse me, we are not really accepting the bare possibility that God exists or there is a God. Rather, we are automatically accepting the very existence of God. Two things can be learned from this exercise. And here's what we find in Davis. First, it is not true that every coherent concept is exemplified by some possible object. Take the concept of unicorn X, which Rowe defines as an existing unicorn. Note that some possible object is a unicorn, but since, in fact, no unicorns exist, no possible object is a unicorn X. That is, unicornixes, despite the coherence of their concept or definition, are not possible things because no possible thing that does not in fact exist can possibly be a unicornix. Here then we have a coherent concept that fails to be exemplified by anything coherent. So the only way to know that unicornixes are possible is to know that unicornixes exist. Second, the simple ontological argument begs the question, because we cannot know that the second premise is true unless we know that the conclusion is true. And this is because of the fact that if it happens that no existing thing is supremely perfect, then the second premise is false. Rowe thinks that the same sort of criticism can be leveled at the ontological argument, even though he grants that in Anselm's ontological argument, we do not arrive at no non-existing thing as God as a matter of definition. But it is still true, says Rowe, that we cannot know certain premises without also knowing the conclusion to the ontological argument. The premises containing a preliminary conclusion are the greatest conceivable being can possibly exist in reality. That is, it is not an impossible thing. That's the second premise of our ontological argument. And the fourth premise is whatever exists only in the mind that might possibly exist in reality might possibly be greater than it is. By granting these premises, we have already granted the conclusion. How so? These two premises together automatically entail a preliminary conclusion, namely that no non-existing thing can be God. And if no non-existing thing can be God, then either the idea of God is incoherent or God actually exists. Hence, by accepting premise two, one has granted more than one intends, and thus the ontological argument begs the question. In other words, we are automatically reasoning in a circle. And since the argument is supposed to be linear, we fail to establish rationally that God exists. Now, my response to this is that the simple ontological argument begs the question, but the ontological argument of Anselm does not. Notice, first of all, that the simple ontological argument has a defective definition of God and that it smuggles in the idea of existence into the idea of God at the outset. But God's existence is the very point in issue, and so the simple ontological argument of Rowe is cheating when it defines God as an existing thing. On the other hand, no questions are being begged by defining God as the greatest conceivable being. And this is true for two reasons. One, the definition, greatest conceivable being, is simply what theists have traditionally meant when they have used the word God. Surely the non-theist does not expect the theist to come up with another definition of the deity and defend that concept of God. If that were the case, then the non-theist would be expecting the theist to demonstrate the existence of God he does not believe in or is not committed to, and that's absurd. Two, or the second point I'd like to make in this regard, is that the words greatest conceivable being do not beg the question by smuggling in the notion of existence at the outset. Hence, theists and atheists ought to be comfortable with this definition of God. To be sure, when we combine our definition of God with other premises, it turns out that the definition logically entails that God is real, but that is a different issue. As Davis rightly insists, the definition, greatest conceivable being, by itself, that is, apart from the other premises of the ontological argument, entails nothing about the existence or non-existence of anything. And if it did, the ontological argument would be informally valid and not particularly interesting. Our second overall point is this. Rowe's discussion of unicornixes notwithstanding, the only way we can know that a proposition is coherent is, well, intuitively. As Davis points out, we simply see that a proposition like there is life on Mars is coherent. And we simply see that a proposition like there are square circles on Mars is not. Hence, if one cannot see that the idea of the greatest conceivable being is incoherent, then one must conclude that there is nothing contradictory about the notion. By the way, this is a problem that a lot of atheists that I run into have. They will say that the concept of God is incoherent, and when you ask them why, they'll say something like, you believe in some timeless fairy tale creature that's floating around out there, and I've never had any experience with that. They're confusing their experiences with the standard of coherency. I've never experienced a Martian, but that doesn't make the idea incoherent. I've never personally experienced Luke Skywalker. And he hasn't appeared to me with his lightsaber drawn. But the idea of Luke Skywalker is coherent.
So they're kind of arguing that their experience, whether they experience the thing or not, is what makes it coherent.
Yes. It's a very myopic vision. This is why that quotation I gave to you of, was it Francis Bacon? He is an ill discoverer. He's a poor discoverer who says that there is no land because all he can see is sea. That's something to always keep in mind. In short, the greatest conceivable being is at least a possible being. And it turns out that Rose Unicornix's example itself begs the question. Indeed, the concept of a unicornix is not coherent, since existence cannot be an essential property of a contingently non-existing thing like a unicorn. These beings cannot be necessarily existing beings and retain their status as unicorns any more than Gonolo's Lost Island. Finally, it is true that our second premise cannot be true unless the conclusion is true. But this does not entail that a person will accept 9 if he accepts 2. Indeed, atheists and agnostics will accept 2 while rejecting 9 all the time. Now, for the sake of those listening to this, 2 is the second premise of our argument. The second premise of our argument is the greatest conceivable being can possibly exist in reality. That is, it is not an impossible thing. That is 2. 9 is the conclusion that God exists. So what I'm saying is, it is true that 2 cannot be true unless 9 is true. It's true that the premise of an argument cannot be true unless the conclusion is true. But that does not entail that a person will accept the conclusion if he accepts that premise. Indeed, atheists and agnostics accept that premise all the time while rejecting 9. The defender of the ontological argument will insist that they are being inconsistent in doing so. However, the fact that they should accept the conclusion if they accept that premise does not mean that they will. Nor does it mean that defenders of the argument are begging any questions by positing the premise. In short, all Roe has really done is describe a characteristic of the argument, namely, if God is possible, then God is real, or, which is the same thing, it is inconsistent to say that the greatest conceivable being does not exist. But showing a characteristic of an argument is not the same as showing its fallacy. Indeed, you can't criticize an argument for doing what it intended to do all along. The whole point of the argument is to show that. In fact, I think that what Roe has done here is he strengthened our case for the ontological argument instead of weakened it. Any questions about that exchange? The ontological argument is based on antiquated ideas. George Smith words his objection in the following way. If many people find it difficult to identify precisely what is wrong with this particular argument, this is mainly because they find it exceedingly difficult to understand. And this is largely because the ontological argument is based on antiquated notions like degrees of perfection and most real being that are foreign to our way of thinking.
I find that insulting.
I do too. I do too. But
tell me what I can't understand.
He's also saying that all of these ideas are antiquated and we should just throw them out. This is a textbook example of chronological snobbery. But we
how is the greatest conceivable being antiquated?
Well, we're about to get into this, but I'm just going to read out his objection. A few lines later, Smith contends this. He says, before Europeans rediscovered the works of Aristotle in the late 12th century, many Christian theologians had embraced the conceptual realism of Plato and later Neoplatonic philosophers like Plotinus. Realism, as it applies to the controversy of the nature of concepts or universals, maintains that a being is more or less real and hence more or less perfect according to the extent of its universality. The highest degree of reality, according to conceptual realism, exists in pure form without matter. Thus, just as Plato had maintained that our ability to conceive of a perfect triangle means that the idea of triangle must exist somewhere in a transcendent world of pure forms, so Anselm maintained that our supposed ability to conceive of a perfect being means that God must really exist, or, to put it in more modern terms, the more abstract something is, the more real it is. Smith goes on to give a lengthy quotation of Wilhelm Windelband, who tells us that given the presuppositions of most medieval philosophers and theologians, Anselm is perfectly correct in his conclusion that from the mere conception of God as most perfect and most real, it must be possible to infer his existence. Smith goes on to wonder how several modern philosophers can continue to defend the proof while rejecting the conceptual realism upon which it depends. So what he's saying is this: we've already gotten rid of Plato, but since the ontological argument is a hangover from Plato's philosophy, we need to get rid of the argument. Now, here's my response. We need to note in passing that Smith's comments do not really refute the argument. When all is said and done, his comments only prove that modern people have a hard time understanding it. As if the average person in the Middle Ages, not to mention scholars such as Gonolo and Aquinas, easily accepted the proof because of the medieval assumptions grounding it. And I mention Aquinas here because Aquinas rejected the argument, and he was medieval. Now, of course, Smith would respond by saying, well, Aquinas comes in the wake of the rediscovery of Aristotle.
Okay. So antiquated.
Yeah. But since Aquinas was so influenced by Aristotle, and since Aristotle was right and Plato was wrong, we must go with Aristotle, right? And we must reject this argument. His comments do not either refute such medieval assumptions or the ontological argument itself. Regarding such medieval assumptions, it should be noted that a plausible case can be made to the effect that universals are real. And for this, I give you the modern philosopher who is very much an empiricist of sorts named J.P. Moreland. He's defended the idea that universals exist. We will explore the possibility further later in the chapter, but suffice to say here that if there really are such things as universals, materialistic atheism must be false. A final point we need to make is that our ontological argument is firmly grounded in intuitions acceptable to the modern person. In fact, our ontological argument does not rest upon the assumption that the more abstract a thing is, the more real it is. In fact, it does not even rest on the assumption that abstract objects exist. That is to say, even a nominalist who thinks that there are no universals, in principle, could accept the argument. Our argument, and this is really Davis's argument that I'm expounding and defending, in our argument, we merely insisted what most people we think would accept as common sense, namely, that something is greater than another, just in case it has more power or abilities or freedom of action than that to which it is being compared. Also, a concept is greater if it exists than it is not. Indeed, between something and nothing, there is no competition. And I don't know why you have to be a Platonist to say that. Hence, a real Paul Bunyan would certainly have been greater than he is or was if he had in fact existed. The same can be said of the greatest conceivable being. A greatest conceivable being can be conceived of as greater than an imaginary one. That is, of course, not contradictory to what Paul Bunyan... It is, of course, not contradictory to say that Paul Bunyan does not exist in reality, for there is nothing about the properties possessed by Bunyan which suggests he is the greatest conceivable being. But it is contradictory to suggest that the greatest conceivable being does not exist, as we have shown. All right, how are we doing? We're marching through these, but I don't know, I find this useful. No matter of fact can, in principle, be demonstrated a priori. This objection has been repeated time and again throughout our discussion, but it's important that we bring to the surface an explicit statement of the objection, for it is only when we do so that we can understand the presuppositions lying behind it. And no one has stated the objection with more rhetorical flair than David Hume. In the mouth of the fictitious character Cleanthes, Hume writes, "There is an evident absurdity in pretending to demonstrate a matter of fact or prove it by any arguments a priori. Nothing is demonstrable unless the contrary implies a contradiction. Nothing that is distinctly conceivable implies a contradiction. Whatever we conceive as existent, we can also conceive of as non-existent. There is no being, therefore, whose non-existence implies a contradiction. Consequently, there is no being whose existence is demonstrable. I propose this argument as entirely decisive, and I'm willing to rest the whole controversy upon it." Earlier in the dialogues, Cleanthes insists that all matters of fact are founded on experience. In other words, Cleanthes is promoting empiricism, the view of knowledge which says that all knowledge has its source in human sense experience. Nothing is in the mind that is not first in the senses. If it is true, then nothing can be known in an a priori way. Everything must be known through experience, including the existence of God. That's his basic argument. Questions about that? This objection merely assumes what it has to prove. That's my response. Empiricism is not obvious. Indeed, no experience has ever told me, at least, that everything is known through experience. Also, a defender of the ontological argument could very well maintain a mild form of empiricism which insists that all things being equal, all knowledge is derived from the senses. However, as the ontological argument shows, not all things are equal. Some things, at least, can be known apart from experience or a priori, simply by analyzing the concept, describing or defining the thing in question. Now, it almost goes without saying that the God of theism is not exactly the same kind of thing as stars, people, and plants. Is it not at least possible that not all things are, or need to be, known in the exact same way? Surely this is possible. And if possible, then it is possible that while things in general are known through experience, God is or can be known apart from experience. Unless Cleanthes or Hume can prove otherwise, that my ideas here are not possibly true, then his objection becomes little more than a dogmatic assertion grounded in an implausibly rigid empiricism. Davis gives another reason to reject this objection. Namely, several of Hume's statements are demonstrably untrue. For example, the statement, "Nothing is demonstrable unless the contrary implies a contradiction," is vague if not obviously false. Indeed, we have already seen several propositions that are not strictly contradictory, but they are nevertheless false, and necessarily so. The statement, "I am the tallest conceivable being," is not strictly illogical, and its contrary, "I am not the tallest conceivable being," implies no contradictions, and we know that the contrary is true. I know that I am not the tallest conceivable being. For the proposition, "I am the tallest conceivable being," is not only false experientially, but is false in a logically necessary way, since the word "tallest" possesses no intrinsic maximum. Also, the statement, "nothing that is distinctly conceivable," implies a contradiction, is false, for it fails to take into consideration the distinction between word conceiving and thing conceiving. We saw this distinction earlier when we noted that, while I can word conceive, or even comprehend the term "greatest conceivable being," I cannot thing conceive or comprehend the thing that is the greatest conceivable being. Hence, Anselm would agree that a person can conceive of the sentence, "God does not exist." However, he would deny that when the word or term "God" is understood, the thing or being that is God can be thought of or conceived of as non-existent. And remember, it's always a difference to say I have imagined God's non-existence, and I've actually conceived of it. Those are two different issues. The ontological argument renders God less than ultimate. This is an interesting objection. Some theists, in an attempt to preserve the transcendence of God, have insisted that the ontological argument makes God less than ultimate. For example, Richard Swinburne writes this. He says, "The premises of such an ontological argument do not merely entail the existence of God, but provide a reason why he exists. The traditional version of the ontological argument is of this kind. It is, it claims, because the existent is more perfect than the non-existent, that there must be a God. But God would seem less than totally supreme if he depended for his existence on something quite other than God, for instance, on such a generally logically necessary principle. Such dependence would not be formally inconsistent with possession of any of the divine properties that I've discussed so far. Still, the claim that there is logically sufficient reason why God exists would seem to make God in some way less than ultimate than he would otherwise be." I find this argument ironic, since, after all, the very point of the ontological argument is to prove the existence of an ultimate reality. That being said, Davis' response to Swinburne is adequate. He says, "This argument is unconvincing. Let's distinguish between the existence of God and proving the existence of God. It is true that the ontological argument, in an attempt to prove the existence of God, depends for its soundness on certain principles, like the premise that it is greater to exist in intellectu and in re than to exist in just intellectu. Or to put it another way, it's just saying it's greater to exist in the mind and reality than just in the mind. But why does it follow? Why does it then follow that God's existence depends in some theologically unacceptable way on those principles? These principles do not provide a sufficient reason why there's a God, not at least in the sense that God's existence depends on them. Suppose I prove by an entirely a priori procedure that there exists at least one prime number between 5 and 10. Would my proof or any of its premises then constitute a logically sufficient reason for the existence of, say, the number 7? Of course not. It only proves that there is such a number. I could not prove that X exists unless X exists. The ontological argument does not supply a sufficient reason for why God exists. It only proves that there is a God. God's existence does not depend upon the ontological argument. By the way, I think that Swinburne's motive for getting rid of the ontological argument is because he believes that God is contingent. Well, he's not contingent on anything. He is a brute fact. He is an open theist, basically. Swinburne thinks that God exists in time, doesn't know the future exhaustively, and that sort of thing. And so he's got to, the open theists have to get rid of the ontological argument, or it's game, set, match for open theism.
And yet this premise of this argument is the ontological argument renders God less than ultimate. Well, wouldn't a contingent being be less than ultimate?
Well, that's exactly what I would say. Now, we're about to shift gears here, because the next argument is really, we're getting into a series of objections noted by St. Thomas Aquinas. St. Thomas Aquinas believed that the ontological argument was unsound. And so in his great Summa, he gives a series of objections to proving the idea that God is self-evident. In other words, the question is raised, is God's existence self-evident? And he gives a series of objections to the idea that God's existence is self-evident. Now, among the arguments showing that God's existence is self-evident is the ontological argument. And so what we're going to do here is we're going to look at the Thomas Aquinas' arguments. But you'll have to know that the prior objection came from Swinburne, and I would consider that friendly fire. I don't agree with his open theism, of course, but he's a fellow theist, and he thinks you can actually show that God exists in some other way. And Thomas Aquinas, of course, is known by all to be a theist, one of the great defenders of theism. Well, he doesn't think that the ontological argument is sound either. He thinks you can prove that God exists in other ways. And this means a lot to me because I am a Thomist. I actually think that Thomas's metaphysics are true. So I'm a weird person because I think that the ontological argument is sound, and that Thomas Aquinas was generally right. So this is one of those areas where I disagree with Thomas. And so we're going to look at this in some detail. Interestingly, Thomas Aquinas and his students have opposed the ontological argument with great vigor. Thomas argues that a thing's or person's existence may be self-evident in two ways. The thing or person itself or himself, that is to say, to the thing or person itself or himself, or to things other than itself or himself. In other words, God may be self-evident to himself, but that doesn't mean that God is self-evident to us. That's what he believes. Now, one must reject the ontological argument, says Thomas, and establish the existence of God through an a posteriori proof, like the cosmological argument. For Thomas's disciples have raised the objection that the ontological argument entails pantheism. That's another objection that comes from people later down the road. While with these general points in mind, it seems best to look at all the Thomistic objections and give a response to each. And so we're going to only look at this one today. And when we come back in 2 weeks, we'll look at the others. But here's the first objection. And now we're about to get into the issue of whether we know God from birth. This is really the point of dispute. This is what Thomas says in general. The existence of God is not self-evident to us because we only have a vague and confused knowledge of the deity implanted in each of us. Thomas considers the first argument that God's existence is self-evident, which is as follows. If the knowledge of a thing is naturally implanted in us, then it is self-evident. But the knowledge of God is naturally implanted within us. Therefore, the existence of God is self-evident. To this argument, Thomas replies, To know that God exists in general and in a confused way is implanted in us by nature, inasmuch as God is man's beatitude. That is to say, God is the only way you can find happiness. For man naturally desires happiness, and what is naturally desired by man must be naturally known to him. This, however, is not to know absolutely that God exists. Just to know that someone is approaching is not the same as to know that Peter is approaching, even though it is Peter who is approaching. For many there are who imagine that man's perfect good, which is happiness, consists in riches and others in pleasures and others in something else. It seems that we can concede everything that Aquinas says here without abandoning the ontological argument. For clearly God's attributes are not wholly known via the ontological argument. All we know is that a personal, necessary, all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good being exists. But there are other attributes of God not explicitly entailed by the ontological argument, like the divine simplicity, impassibility, atemporality, and so forth. On this proof alone, we do not even know that God is in any way causally related to the world. So in a way, our ontological argument illustrates Thomas's point. There is a confused understanding of God that we have at birth, which in and of itself can lead us to affirm the existence of an all-good, all-powerful being. Whether this being caused the world to be, is to be worshipped, is immutable and simple, or should be called Lord, are issues which cannot be addressed by this argument alone. That is, these important issues await the other arguments. In this light, one may wonder why we should entertain the ontological argument in the first place. For surely this vague understanding of the deity is not the living God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Some say it's just a philosophical principle, nothing more. However, we must note that this proof does give us a lot, even if not a full-blown classical theism. The theist now has his foot in the door. Atheism and open theism have been refuted, and it may very well be the case that, with the help of the other proofs, we come to conclude that the omnipotent and omnibenevolent being of ontological argument is, when all is said and done, everything the Bible says about the living and true God, since we have said nothing inconsistent with classical theism. To put it another way, the ontological argument, in and of itself, refutes atheism and open theism, but the ontological argument alone does not establish classical theism. Another point needs to be given with respect to this objection, which is that Abrahamic theists, such as Aquinas, should welcome the ontological argument into their arsenal proofs for the existence of God. Indeed, not only does this proof truly give the atheist a run for his money, for it starts with the fundamental premise of atheism. The world is eternal and uncreated, while at the same time refuting atheism. It seems to be alluded to here and there throughout Scripture. So Thomas argues against the atheist with one hand tied behind his back, as he assumes in his argument that the universe is eternal. The ontological argument is arguing against the atheist with both hands tied behind his back, and he's still kicking his ass. All right? For example, it's not only accepting atheistic premises and still refuting atheism, but it's also alluded to in Scripture. For example, speaking about the knowledge of God held by all people, Paul tells us that that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. He goes on to say that God has made himself known through the created order, a point we turn to when discussing the other arguments. But given the fact that God has made his existence known within them, that is, within all people, does it not stand to reason that if the God of Abraham is real, he would have left some knowledge of himself somewhere safe in human consciousness? Perhaps this is what the preacher is getting at when he tells us that God has set eternity in our hearts. Hence, it seems reasonable to think that the ontological argument justifies various assertions found in the Bible. A final point we wish to make regarding Thomas's contention is that we think he is incorrect regarding the innate knowledge of God held by all humans. There is a debate that has long divided Abrahamic theists regarding the innate knowledge of God. Namely, is our innate knowledge of God merely an innate capacity to know God, or is it an innate awareness of the basic content of theism? The latter would entail that all humans know God, what God is, or at least what God is like, from birth, which would also entail the capacity to know more about God as they encounter his revelation in nature. The former would allow for a knowledge of God as humans encounter nature throughout their lives, but it would imply that there is no content of what God is resident within the human mind at birth. To be sure, the ontological argument we have been defending in this chapter does not settle the dispute between the contentists and the capacitists. That's my terms. Those are my terms. For a capacitist could maintain, as some of Thomas's disciples do, that it is through experience that humans first encounter the word God, along with the definition of him as the greatest conceivable being. When these ideas are put together, a capacitist can infer the existence of God. But there is another ontological argument in history, in the history of thought, which entails that all humans know what God is from birth. And here I offer you another hero of mine, Jonathan Edwards. And so this argument I'm going to give you is an attempt to show you that Edwards proves that we're all born into this world with a contentful knowledge of God. Jonathan Edwards provided a most ingenious version of the ontological argument, which seems to be an a priori proof bordering on the a posteriori. As the quotation below demonstrates, Edwards' version mainly concentrates on the notion of being rather than perfection or even conception. Edwards moves not from the idea of greatness to the reality of greatness, but from the rationally inescapable being to necessary being. This is what he writes. A state of absolute nothing is a state of absolute contradiction. Absolute nothing is the aggregate of all the absurd contradictions in the world. A state when there is neither body, nor spirit, nor space, neither empty space nor full space, neither little nor great, narrow nor broad, neither infinitely great space nor finite space, nor a mathematical point, neither up nor down, neither north nor south. I don't mean as it is with respect to the body of the earth or some other great body, but no contrary points, nor positions, nor directions. No such things as either here or there, this way or that way, or only one way. When we go about to form an idea of perfect nothing, we must shut out all of these things. We must shut out of our minds both space that is something in it and space that is nothing in it. We must not allow ourselves to think of the least part of space, never so small, nor must we suffer our thoughts to take sanctuary in a mathematical point. When we go to expel body out of our thoughts, we must be sure not to leave empty space in the room of it. And when we go to expel emptiness from our thoughts, we must not think to squeeze it out by anything close, hard, and solid, but we must think of the same thing that sleeping rocks dream of, and not till then do we get an adequate idea of nothing. So what is the definition of nothing? What sleeping rocks dream about. Now, what is Edwards getting at here? He's saying it's impossible for you to conceive of nothing. Because even when you conceive of nothing, you're conceiving of something. By the way, he wrote these words when he was 12. We're not 100% sure that that's true, but he was probably no older than 18 when he wrote these words. Because he wrote these words when he was at Yale. And he went to Yale when he was 12 years old. Okay, so while you were wasting time running around doing what you're doing, you know, it's like my history professor, when he introduced me to Edwards, and I really fell in love with this man's heart for God. And when my history professor at Dallas Seminary, John Hanna, told us about Edwards, he gave this joke at the same time. When Edwards was three and four and five, he was parsing Latin, Greek, and Hebrew verbs. You know, it's like, meanwhile, I'm urinating in my sandbox. It's like, that's the difference between me and Edwards right there. I'm urinating in the sandbox, and he is parsing Latin, Greek, and Hebrew verbs. To think of absolute nothing, and this is my exposition, to think of absolute nothingness, according to Edwards, is impossible, for even when I contemplate nothing, I'm contemplating something. Hence, we don't know what we say if we think it possible in itself that there should not be entity. All of this entails, of course, that we can only think of being, which in turn entails that being as such is logically necessary. Since we cannot conceive of nothing, we cannot conceive of nothing as ever existing at any time. That's a contradiction too. Thus, necessary being must be thought of as eternal being. And since it is impossible to conceive of nothing, it is impossible to conceive of nothing as being in any place, and hence we see that this necessary eternal being must be infinite and omnipresent. Furthermore, since it is impossible for us to be conscious of nothing, it is impossible for us to think that something should be from all eternity and nothing all the while be conscious of it. Therefore, we conclude that a necessary, impersonal, or conscious being exists, for it is impossible to conceive of him as anything but consciously existent. Therefore, from the rational inescapability of being, we conclude that God is. Now, that's an interesting argument for God's existence that a 12-year-old came up with. John Frame, and he's the only person I know that's given an objection to this argument, he's given the following objection. There's an obvious objection to this argument, however, which Edwards doesn't even mention. However infinite being may be, our idea of being extends to finite being as well. Therefore, if being is divine, then finite beings are a part of the divine being. In other words, without some modifications, the argument proves pantheism, and the argument fails to draw any distinction between the kind of infinity, eternity, omnipresence, etc., attributable to a pantheistic God, and the very different but similar-sounding attributes revealed concerning the God of Scripture. My response, and this is again a criticism of Frame, Frame always says things like this, and it's almost like he doesn't read carefully enough. Edwards has refuted pantheism in the argument. First of all, the argument does not entail pantheism, for it has I say that for two reasons. One, it would be invalid for us to reason as follows: being is omnipresent, therefore I am omnipresent. But if pantheism is true, then we would be required to draw out that conclusion. And it should go without saying that the pantheist has the burden to supply the missing premise in the argument. Second of all, the fact that the pantheist cannot logically infer I am omnipresent from being as omnipresent should force him to recognize that there really are two modalities operating in reality, namely necessary being and contingent being. Or as Edwards puts it, the nearer in nature beings are to God, so much the more properly they are beings and more substantial, and that the spirits are much more properly beings and more substantial than bodies. Hence, we see how God is said all more properly to be ens entium, the most real being. Or if there was nothing else in the world but bodies, the only real being, so that it may be said in a stricter sense than hitherto, thou art, and there is none else besides thee. He's quoting the writings of Isaiah there. If you look at the footnote that I have there, I say, whereas Isaiah argued that Yahweh is God and there is none beside him, Edwards is contending that God is the most real being and there is no real being besides him. This is not to deny the reality of things other than God, but to emphasize the fact that nothing would be real if it were not for God. In Edwards' words, bodies have no substance of their own. All that is real is immediately in the first being. Once the distinction between ens entium and all else is recognized, one must conclude that pantheism is false. And Edwards does recognize this distinction. And I get really hot under my collar when people say that he's a pantheist. Now, you'll remember when we did Weltanschauung, I basically quoted John Cooper, who lumped Edwards as a pantheist. And I gave that argument that theism automatically entails pantheism. And I mentioned all these theistic philosophers that people have looked at and said, you're just a pantheist. Well, Edwards is one of them. So one of the things I'm going to do here is I'm going to finally vindicate the claim that Edwards was not a pantheist. When I was doing that in Weltanschauung, I was just trying to get to the conclusion as to whether God existed or not, and I didn't care about historic exegesis of various theologians. But now I'm coming full circle, and I'm addressing this issue. A second point that I want to make is this. The Edwardsian ontological argument does entail that God is being, which Edwards elsewhere equates with being in general. But to insist that God is being in general is not to identify him with every particular thing we encounter in our experience. And when we observe that what Edwards means when he equates God with being in general, we immediately realize that this Puritan of Puritans never confused the creature with the creator. This is what Edwards says. He says, when we speak of being in general, we may be understood to speak of the divine being, for he is an infinite being. Therefore, all others must necessarily be considered as nothing. As to bodies, we have shown in another place that they have no proper being of their own. And as to spirits, they are the communications of the great original spirit. And doubtless in metaphysical strictness and propriety, he is as there is none else. He is likewise infinitely excellent, and all excellence and beauty is derived from him in the same manner as all being and all other excellence is in strictness only a shadow of his. All spiritual excellence is resolved into love. That Edwards is willing to call God or being in general infinite love, whereby all other beings are a mere shadow by comparison, is proof that all who try to make him out to be a pantheist are just mistaken. As Piper explains in another context, it seems to me that Edwards is trying to come to terms with at least two things here. One is the philosophical implication that an infinite being who exists alone from eternity cannot confront being except when that comes from his own being and is absolutely dependent on him. In this sense, he comprehends all being. The other thing he is trying to come to terms with is the biblical witness in texts like Acts 17, for in him we live and move and have our being. Or Colossians 1, by or in him all things consist. Or 1 Corinthians 15, that God may be all in all. Do you have any questions about those quotations? Now, what I want to do is I'm going to walk you through the footnote because it's very important for me. And it also highlights some of the things that we talked about in the Trinity. So some things hopefully will be locked together for you, because when we talked about the Trinity last Sunday, I didn't get into this because I knew that you and I would get into this in the ontological argument. So this should really help you with the Trinity as I walk you through this. So if you go to footnote 50, I point out that many will not charge Edwards with pantheism, but they will charge him with panentheism. Even John Gerstner, perhaps the greatest evangelical Edwardsian scholar of the previous generation, writes this. He says, it would appear that Edwards was pantheistic by implication and panentheistic by intention. So for him, Edwards intended to be a panentheist, which I find amazing that Gerstner would say such a thing and still want to actually embrace Edwards as one of his heroes. Cooper is a little bit more careful than Edwards. He says, Edwards' philosophical doctrine of God is traditional classical theism. He argues that God is the eternal, infinite, necessary, perfect, self-sufficient being who is the cause of everything else that exists. The question of panentheism arises with respect to his ontology of creatures and their relation to God. Cooper then writes, his, that is to say, Edwards' ontology of creatures comes to this, to be is to be thought by God. Later we were given the following argument. The Neoplatonism of Edwards' theology is especially evident in his famous treatise concerning the end for which God created the world. He invokes the analogy of the world's soul for God. The whole universe should proceed with a view of God as if the whole system were animated and directed by one common soul, or as if such an arbiter, possessed of perfect wisdom and rectitude, became the common soul of the universe. Edwards also regards creation as an inevitable emanation of the divine nature, not a divine choice. We may suppose that a disposition in God, Edwards says, as an original property of his nature, to an emanation of his own infinite fullness, what excited him to create the world, and so that the emanation itself was aimed at by him as a last end of the creation. Edwards denies that this implies any deficiency or lack in God. He says this, 'tis no argument of the emptiness or deficiency of a fountain that is inclined to overflow. He affirms that God is free in being, unconstrained. Edwards says he is independent on any other that should hinder him. Yet by nature, Cooper says, God cannot fail to overflow in love and self-glorification by generating creatures that love and glorify him. Edwards says, God would be less happy if he was less good, or if he had not that perfection of nature, which consists in propensity of nature to diffuse its own fullness. So there's the principle of fecundity. The goodness is naturally diffusive of itself. For Edwards, God's sovereignty does not include the choice whether to create the world. All things considered, his affirmation that the whole is of God and in God and to God is best construed philosophically as a panentheism that borders on Spinozan pantheism. We will take the points made by Cooper in reverse order. To the issue of whether or not he had any affinities with Spinoza, it needs to be pointed out that Edwards himself denied any affinity for pantheistic monism. Indeed, even in his own day, his expressions could be taken as cryptic endorsements of pantheism. Thus, in his personal correspondence, he wrote the following. And now, this is amazing to me. Edwards actually explicitly said, I'm not trying to say that. And yet people still try to interpret him as a pantheist. As to my saying that the Spirit of God in his saving operation communicates himself to the soul in his own proper nature, implying, as you suppose, God's communicating his essence. After all that is said, the objection is only about the use of language and propriety of expressions. It can't be anything else, for I've particularly explained my meaning and expressly declared what I do not mean, that by his proper nature I don't mean essence, and have also declared particularly what I do mean, that by the Spirit of God communicating himself in his proper nature, I mean communicating something of his holiness. So what is Edwards saying? I'm not telling you that I think that we actually share God's essence. I simply mean that God has given something of his holiness to us. Now, it would have been better had Edwards imbibed a little bit more Thomas Aquinas, because Aquinas settled this issue by saying that we share in God's attributes analogically. And just that one saying gets rid of this idea that we're fused with God. Okay. And Edwards says this, in this explanation, I am careful to give grace, which is in the hearts of the saints, is of the same nature with the divine holiness as much as it is possible for it to be, which is infinitely less in degree. So what is he saying? God gives his holiness to us, but not in such a way that it's the same holiness, because God's holiness is infinite and ours is finite. Now again, had he just said analogical, he would have ended the whole thing, but he didn't have that term in his nomenclature. So that by the exceeding great objection is that I, in your opinion, signify this that I declare to be my meaning by an improper expression, and if that be still a grand difficulty with you, I hope you will consider the matter more fully. As Claycorn states, lest there be any doubt as to Jonathan Edwards' intent on the score, the present letter repeatedly rejects monism, the doctrine of believers being or becoming one with the divine substance. To the issue of God's freedom in creating the world, could God have chosen not to make the actual world? Could he have chosen to make no world at all? Several points need to be made. First, it is true that Edwards sees God's disposition to emanate his own infinite fullness into creation as the divine motive for creating the world. Two, we need to remember that Edwards qualifies all of this in the next section, where he answers objections to his doctrine. In fact, the very first objection to Edwards' view of creation is that it compromises the absolute independence of God. To this objection, Edwards writes, many have wrong notions of God's happiness as resulting from his absolute self-sufficiency, independence, and immutability. Though it be true that God's glory and happiness are infinite and can't be added to, unchangeable for the whole and every part of which he is perfectly independent of the creature, yet it don't hence follow, nor is it true, that God has no real and proper delight, pleasure, or happiness in any of his acts or communications relative to the creature or effects he produces in them, or in anything he sees in the creature's qualifications, dispositions, actions, and state. God may have a real and proper pleasure or happiness in seeing the happy state of the creature, yet this may not be different from his delight in himself, being a delight in his own infinite goodness, or the exercise of that glorious propensity of his nature to diffuse and communicate himself, and so gratifying his inclination of his own heart. This delight, which God has in his creature's happiness, can't properly be said to be what God receives from the creature. For 'tis only the effect of his own work and communications to the creature in making it and admitting it to participation in his fullness. As the sun receives nothing from the jewel that receives its light and shines only by a participation in its brightness. We stop at this point to make a few observations. First, that a main purpose Edwards has in articulating his creation doctrine and the way he does is to refute those who deny God's genuine pleasure in his creation or his creatures. God really does take pleasure in the creation, says Edwards. But he then qualifies this by insisting that God's pleasure in creating the world is in no way derived from the world. Just as the sun receives nothing from the light it produces in the jewel, so also God receives nothing from the glory he dispenses in his creation. God is genuinely pleased by his creatures, but he in no way receives this pleasure from the creatures. In Edwards' words, nor do any of these things argue for any dependence in God on the creature for happiness. Though he has real pleasure in the creature's holiness and happiness, yet this is not properly any pleasure he receives from the creature. For these things are what he gives the creature. They are wholly and entirely from him. Therefore, they are nothing. They are nothing that they give to God by which they add to him. His rejoicing therein is rather rejoicing in his own acts and his own glory expressed in those acts than a joy derived from the creature. God's joy is dependent on nothing besides his own act, which he exerts with an absolute and independent power. Now, remember what Alfred North Whitehead said. He said, it is just as true to say that God creates the world as that the world creates God. That is nothing like what Edwards is saying here. Absolutely nothing. And why anyone would continue to say he's a panentheist is beyond me. Now, I'm about to quote the lines that follow, which we have already seen from Cooper, which we will italicize. And notice that these lines appear in a paragraph where Edwards is actually arguing for God's absolute independence. Edwards writes, and yet, in some sense, it can be truly said that God has the more delight and pleasure for the holiness and happiness of his creatures, because God would be less happy if he was less good, or if he had not that perfection of nature which consists in the propensity of nature to diffuse his own goodness. And he would be less happy if it were possible for him to be hindered in the exercise of his goodness and his other perfections in their proper effects. But he has complete happiness because he has these perfections and can't be hindered in exercising and displaying them in their proper effects. And this surely is not thus because he is dependent, but because he is independent on any other that should hinder him. Again, we quote a line found in Cooper's paragraph, in context, also italicized. From what has been said, it appears that the pleasure that God hath in those things which have been mentioned is rather a pleasure in diffusing and communicating to the creature than in receiving from the creature. Surely it is no argument of indigence in God that he is inclined to communicate of his infinite fullness. 'Tis no argument of the emptiness or deficiency of a fountain that is inclined to overflow. Another thing signified by these expressions of Scripture is that nothing that is from the creature adds to or alters God's happiness as though it were changeable, either by increase or diminution. So, as Edwards says, there is some sense in which God has more delight with his creatures than he would without them. For in creating the world, God fulfills his disposition to emanate his glory. But whatever this sense actually is or entails, we should not infer from this that God's happiness is in any way dependent upon his creatures. Nor should we conclude that God was not free in creating the universe. Indeed, at the end of the dissertation, Edwards responds to those who think that his doctrine may diminish the creature's obligation to praise God for the existence he has given them. He points out that the only reason such an obligation might be diminished is if his doctrine implied that the creature does not benefit very much from God's creating activity, or that God's action does not directly benefit the creature, or that God's disposition to create lacks virtue, or that the beneficence is not so free. Do you get this? The only way that my doctrine would diminish our reasons for praising God is if God's goodness in creating is not free. But it's been observed that none of these things take place with regard to that disposition which has been supposed to have excited God to create the world. God was absolutely free in creating the world. In other words, Edwards explicitly affirms God's freedom in creating the world. As Piper explains, it is a crucial distinction to say that God would be less happy if he were less good, rather than to say God would be less happy if his creation did not exist. It is not the existence of creation per se that elicits happiness in God. Rather, it is what creation says about the way God is that elicits happiness in God. As Edwards said, God's joy is dependent on nothing besides his own act, which he exerts with an absolute and independent power. That is not panentheism. Finally, it is true that Edwards invokes a world-soul analogy to describe God's relationship to the world. But as Cooper's quotation itself indicates, Edwards is only giving an analogy and carefully qualifies his words with the ever-important words or phrase, as if the whole system of the cosmos were animated and directed by one common soul. While at first glance this statement may have affinities with modern panentheism, which often insists that the universe is God's body, God is the soul of the world, Edwards earlier tells us that his analogy in no way implies any kind of codependence between God and the universe as one finds in modern panentheism. And he is, this is what Edwards says, he says, as he is God over all, to whom all are properly subordinate, and on whom all depend, worthy to reign as supreme head with absolute and universal dominion, so it is fit that he should be so regarded by all and in all proceedings and effects throughout the whole system that this universality of things and their whole compass and their whole compass and series should look to him and respect him in such a manner as that respect to him should reign over all respect of other things, and that regard to creatures should universally be subordinate and subject. Thus, the affinities Edwards might have with panentheism may very well indicate not that he was, Pace Gerstner, panentheistic in intention, but that he, as a representative of classical theism, gave the panentheists all they could ever ask for in a worldview without falling into the incoherence that is panentheism. In short, theism is the true panentheism. All right, do you have any questions about that? Mm-mm. All right, I'm going to finish this out. We just have a little bit more, and then we'll end this. For Edwards, then, the knowledge of being just is the knowledge of God. As Gerstner explains, if Edwards closed his eyes and thought about being per se, he would think of him as conscious, eternal, infinite, independent, and necessary, with any other possible being dependent upon him. If Edwards opened his eyes to the world around him, he would conclude that nothing he sees is that eternal, necessary, and most real being. We think the same point applies to the child. When a newly born infant intuitively realizes that there is something, that being is, and to the degree the child knows being, to that same degree he knows God. As he grows up, the child understands that the world of his experience is not the eternal, infinite, and necessary being. And so he intuitively realizes that such a being must exist beyond the world of his experience. Thus, from birth, all have an innate or contentful knowledge of God. And what is the contentful knowledge of God? It is being. And here's another way to look at it, and I wish I had the board here to illustrate this. If you write the word being, you'll notice that all the laws of logic apply to it. So what is being? Being is itself. Being is not not contradictory. There is no third option between being and non-being and so forth. Also, being doesn't break the law of causality.
But
why?
The potential of being.
Huh?
What about the potential of being?
Okay, but when the child opens up his eyes, he sees that things have potential, and therefore they can't be this being he thinks of. So, grounded in our idea of being just is the knowledge of God. And since the laws of logic totally apply to being, like being is itself, I am who I am, being cannot be what it is not. All right, there's no third option. And beyond all that, being is uncaused because of the law of causality. We actually have an eternal being who is holy himself. And this the child sort of intuitively recognizes. And so what God does is he implants the knowledge of himself in the child insofar as that child knows being, the child knows God. And that's why I believe wholeheartedly when a child is born in this world, he's born with the knowledge of God. So when George Smith says everyone is born an atheist, no, 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 everyone's born an implicit theist. We think Edwards' doctrine of being is the philosophical expression of Calvin's famous doctrine of the sense of divinity, which he believes inheres in all men. As experience shows, says Calvin, God has sown a seed of religion in all men. Indeed, there is within the human mind, and indeed by natural instinct, an awareness of the divinity. This we take to be beyond controversy. To prevent anyone from taking refuge in the pretense of ignorance, God himself has implanted in all men a certain understanding of his divine majesty. Hence, men of sound judgment, says Calvin, will always be sure that a sense of divinity can never be effaced, which can never be effaced, is engraved upon men's minds. Indeed, the perversity of the impious, who, though they struggle furiously, are unable to extricate themselves from the fear of God, is abundant testimony that this conviction, namely that there is some God, is naturally inborn in all and is fixed deep within, as it were, in the very marrow. In summary, Thomas's objection to the ontological argument assumes that we have no contentful knowledge of God at birth. But Edward's ontological argument justifies the traditional Reform view that God has planted a sense of divinity within all of us, a sense which actually gives us content, which is to say, an incomplete knowledge of what God is like or what God is. Therefore, Thomas's objection is invalid. Now, what that means, Nathan, is that you don't have just one argument for God's existence in this section. You now have two. You have Anselm's ontological argument and Edwards' ontological argument. And what we're about to do is we're about to see yet a third argument and a fourth and a fifth and a sixth. So we're actually going to see this start piling on. And so next week or in 2 weeks, we're going to meet back and we will actually cover several more of these arguments, starting with Augustine's argument from truth.